Okay, thanks very much for inviting me. And like I say, I do just think it's just really exciting and important to share these ideas. And, you know, I feel like it's really the, but it's not the beginning, because I know that groups, No Borders groups have been going for a long time, but I think that they're growing and they're going to carry on growing and carry on kind of developing. So I feel like it's really, I'm really lucky to be here. And I just wanted to take advantage of the fact that I've got a little moment to just pick up on the debate that we had earlier about the idea or the term of migrant and how useful it is or it isn't. And I think maybe one of the things that Anne was flagging is that the problem with the idea of migrant isn't actually to do with problematizing mobility, but to do with the dichotomy between us and them, between like making movement an issue for one group of people and not for another group of people. And why is that? So it can be something that divides us and doesn't let us see actually what our common interests are. And that, so I think we have to be careful about making it into, on the one hand, you've got to see it all the time as being really important, because that's how states divide people and that has a real impact on people. But on the other hand, it's not real. There's no such thing really as a migrant. I mean, so it's kind of working within that term. And I was very struck by, I don't know if anyone's read the document Enforcing the Rules, 2007. It's basically the Home Office enforcement strategy, 5-year enforcement strategy. And what's interesting about it is they have a problem with enforcement, which is basically, enforcement is really about enforcing controls against black people and poor people. It's not really about Australians or Americans. And actually, when you look at the figures, there's a lot of overstayers are actually US and Australian citizens. So now how do they get round that kind of problem? Because they don't want to say, oh, we're only going to enforce against particular people. So what they did in this document was they devised all these ways of showing who causes harm through immigration. And it's a really interesting document. I really recommend anyone to read it, because it is kind of quite fascinating. They've got this paragraph there which says, you know, well, what do we do about overstayers? And in that paragraph it says, well, some overstayers don't cause much harm. Overstayers from countries of a high GDP don't cause harm. The harm comes from overstayers from countries of low GDP who might go on to claim asylum, so we're going to have to prioritise those people. So, to me, I mean, so there it is in black and white, really. And I think that that is something about the terminology of migrants, because actually, when we use the term, really in our heads, we're not thinking about American bankers or Australian backpackers, you know. And so it, I think we just have to always be thinking about that and be careful and kind of just not letting it just go as taken for granted. So I think that one reason that Chris asked me to speak was because of the volume that we did, No Borders as Practical Politics. I think it might be outside. Which is an edited volume that I put together with Nandita Sharma and Cynthia Wright, which was really trying to challenge the idea. Yeah, that one. If people want to have a look, I could pass it round. Yeah. It was trying to challenge the idea that No Borders is just a dream, you know, it's a fantasy. And I mean, when people say, well, No Borders is utopian, I have to say, well, sorry, I think actually Borders is, it's not utopian, it's dystopian, because you can't control borders. You're never going to be able to control borders. So why should you slag me off for saying that, oh, you're just engaged in some fantasy, but actually say that being able to control borders is completely reasonable and something that everyone is going to, that we're going to somehow be able to achieve. And actually, I'm also struck by the fact that, as Bob said earlier, that actually, if you go into a room and you say to people, you know, well, do you think in your ideal world, would there be borders? And most people actually end up saying, no, they don't think, you know, in an ideal world, that wouldn't figure. But I think where no borders is different is it doesn't just say, well, in an ideal world, we can all agree that this is the best of possible worlds to have no borders. But to say, in a just world would have no borders. Not the best world, a just world. Because then, what that's doing, that's saying, we don't live in a just world, actually. And we don't want to tolerate the injustice that borders is part of. We want to have a just world where people aren't dying to get across borders. And we want to have a just world where a baby born in a territory which is, I don't know, which we now call Congo, has the same rights, the same possibility of health and education and a long life as a baby who is born into a family in the territory of Britain. And let's, of course, remember that people born into these territories also have very different life expectancies. You know, it's not like, oh, everyone's equal in Britain, because we're not. But I think it's also about recognising that borders don't just reflect inequality, but that they actually make it, they actually produce inequality and injustice. And that, as Clara said earlier, that states are not just lucky. We're not just rich because we're full of rich, because, you know, because Britain's a great place and because, you know, everyone here is so clever. We're here, we're rich because of centuries of exploitation and injustice. That's how come Britain happens to be rich and Nigeria happens to be poor. So it's about history, it's about remembering histories and remembering that nation states aren't just natural constructions and the world isn't just naturally divided into countries and that people have always moved. And I think it is worth thinking about it also historically. And I'm going to have a little bit of a sort of deviation because I've just been reading about this and I think it's really interesting. And I'm sorry if it's not, but it'll only be for 2 minutes. But in 1349, we had the first statute against vagrancy. And that basically was after the Black Death. There was a shortage of labour and also serfs were moving from their masters and they were going into cities and they were being free. And the price of labour was going up. So what happened with the statute of vagrancies? There were three things that were done. One was to say that vagrancy produces social disorder. Oh, no social cohesion because, you know, feudalism is kind of coming to an end. So social disorder, that's what mobility, and mobility of the poor, remember, not just anyone's mobility, mobility of the poor. Social disorder. Second thing it did was it criminalised, or not criminalised, if there's a historian here, but made punishable social solidarity. So if you were to give alms to what they called a valiant beggar, to somebody who was able to work, then you could be put in the stocks, and I can't remember what the punishment was. So it criminalised social solidarity. If there were serfs around, they shouldn't be travelling about. They should be back with their masters. It also required all masters and lords to pay pre-plague wage rates. So it was keeping the wage rate down. So here you see mobility. What's that do? It causes problems for wages and for masters and lords. It causes problems for social disorder. And it produces this social solidarity, which really has got to get clamped down on. And what you see when you look through the statutes over the years is how then there became a whole load of statutes to do with labour and labour costs, and another load of statutes to do with arms and then what later became welfare, and the vagrancy statutes all became to do with social disorder. So mobility of poor people, there's always been this threat and this fear that it produces social disorder. And I think that that's really important to remember and also to kind of take as a kind of a strength, because when we say illegal immigrants are not criminals, what do we mean? What we mean is illegal immigrants are not morally weird or bad people. They're just human beings. The same goes for criminals. They're also, it's a category, these are categories that are produced by the state and are produced by the state and that enable states to exercise control over people, to exercise force and coercion over them. And I think we need to be starting to think about what relations we can build, what alliances we can build with groups who are also in these, put into these positions by states. And in the United States, in 10 states in the US, if you are a convicted felon, and most convicted felons, let's remember, are black, and the vast majority are in for minor drugs offences. If you're a convicted felon, you lose the right to vote for life. You lose your right to any food aid, Medicaid, or any form of educational grant for life. So what's the value of citizenship to a young... And in those 10 states, in any one day, two-thirds of black men are in the criminal justice system. So what is the value of citizenship, of formal citizenship, to those to groups like that? I think we need to be thinking also about, and I think the kinds of work that State Watch does is actually really invaluable for that. We need to be thinking about what forms of solidarity we can share across different groups who are marginalised and who are made to feel like they're somehow morally deviant. And part of that is also about benefits, I think, and about the idea of benefits, scroungers and dependents. Because, again, just to get back a bit to the history, there's always been this figure from 1349 onwards of the valiant beggar, the person who actually is just too lazy and who can work. And it keeps reappearing in all of the statutes, all of the legislation. Those are the people who don't deserve help. They don't deserve alms. And what's really interesting is that you see in 1662, the Statute of Settlement, it starts to change. And it's not just the valiant beggar who can work, but it's also the person who doesn't belong, the person who isn't settled in the parish. Because at that time, there were 15,000 different parishes in England and Wales. And basically, because alms had gone from being a form of solidarity between individuals to being something that was taken from ratepayers and then centrally administered by the parish, then there became this thing of the ratepayer saying, well, we don't want to pay for these migrants who are coming because they don't belong here. We don't want they're poor, and actually they're going to start claiming from us. And so I was interested in what someone was saying about Mauritius, because at that time, if it was suspected that you were wanting, that you were maybe going to claim from the poor law, so not even that you were, but that it was suspected that you might, you would be removed to your parish of settlement. And these are not all your parish of birth. And these are not small numbers. In 1 year, I can't remember when it was, 1670-something, there were 50,000 people removed through Bristol and Liverpool alone to Ireland because they were paupers. So that's like a lot of people, a lot of poor people being moved about. When all this changed was actually when the Statute of Settlement finally kind of disappeared, was actually at the beginning, it was post-war, at the beginning of the modern welfare state, when it didn't really matter anymore which parish you were in. What mattered was, were you within the nation, were you within the boundaries of the territory? So there's a long history of poor people being moved about. And what happened when you had these borders put down at the around the territory was that you had, not only does work for non-citizens, for migrants, that becomes a right. It becomes a right that they don't have access to. But for people who are citizens, people who are in the territory, it becomes a duty. It becomes something that you have to do, or else you're not going to get any benefit. So it's a kind of magic trick that somehow Borders manages to do. And that's why I think we also need to be really thinking about benefits, benefit claiming and unemployment, because we also have to remember that it's not like these are really great jobs. It's not like they're fantastic jobs. In TUC did a piece of research in 2008 on vulnerable employment, and they found that over 50% of the jobs that were being advertised at that time in Job Centre Plus were for agency work. So for work where you're very vulnerable, where you don't have security, where wages are very low and you have very limited employment rights. So these are not great jobs. When they say British jobs for British workers, now here we've got, I did a bit of research. The cost of national minimum wage enforcement is, in 2009-10, 8.8 million. And you had 93 minimum wage compliance officers. The cost of the UKBA in-country asylum and removal processes. So this isn't Borders, this is just the sort of in-country stuff. 884.3 million, so that's like 100 times national minimum wage. And for the local immigration team officers alone, 7,500 immigration officers versus 93 national minimum wage compliance officers. So to me, that says something about British jobs for British workers. It says something about the idea that immigration controls are there to protect the British workforce. That actually, you know, we have these immigration controls because otherwise all these people are going to be coming in and lowering the cost of labour. No, actually, immigration controls produce a vulnerable workforce, as I know Clara's going to be talking about. Immigration controls actually undermine the position of all workers, not just of migrant workers. And, you know, we really had to start taking this kind of funny logic and really interrogating it, because it doesn't make sense. Workers are protected by organising and by struggle, not through immigration controls. And then, briefly, I wanted to talk about trafficking. How much longer have I got? 10 minutes or something? Is that all right? I wanted to talk briefly about trafficking because I think the problem with trafficking is that the language of trafficking has actually enabled the idea of human rights as being protected by border controls to move right into the heart of immigration enforcement. If you look at the legislation, in 2002, there was, what's the white paper in 2002? Secure Borders, Safe Haven. There's two mentions of trafficking, and they say it doesn't happen very often. Most so-called illegal immigrants are in Britain, you know, by choice. By 2007, that document I was telling you about, John Reid, then Home Office Minister, says 3/4 of illegal immigrants are trafficked. And so we have to, you know, we've got to protect them. This is to keep them from harm, because all these bad things, these poor people don't know what's going to happen to them. We're going to have to protect them by deporting them, of course. But, you know, that's just part of immigration controls. And actually, we should all be checking up to see, you know, maybe there's whole some interesting websites on this. If you look on the human trafficking Sheffield thing, they have a campaign called the Blue Blindfold campaign, where they can tell you how you've got to look out for trafficked people. And it says things like white vans coming to the house in the middle of the night, a large amount of takeaway food consumed. To me it begins to sound like a student. So you have, so basically it's, but what it does is it says, you know, you need to keep an eye out open for these things because, you know, these people, they might be in slavery and, you know, you could be reporting it to immigration and stopping it. So the way trafficking, in that document that I told you about, is, I think, as I remember, it's 32 pages long, and trafficking is mentioned, and sorry, harm, the idea of immigration controls as being about preventing harm, is mentioned 72 times. And now the main thing about immigration controls is supposed to be that they prevent harm. Now, of course, in some ways, I think you can say, well, there's a good side to that, which shows that people actually feel uncomfortable about enforcement. Because I think that even though people kind of might say that borders are, you know, they're either, but they might think they're not a great thing, but they might say, well, but we have to have them or whatever. But actually, when it actually comes down to it and they see raids and they see their workmates being picked up, a lot of people actually think, oh, that's a bit, they don't really feel very comfortable about it. And so I think the idea of, you know, immigration controls as being actually helpful to migrants is something that has really been deliberately pushed and pushed through the trafficking agenda. Because, of course, why can't people who are trafficked actually go to the normal mechanisms of applying for support? Why can't they go to the women's aid centres or to the other places that are available for people who are citizens? Because of their immigration status. Because that's the problem, is actually the state is actually preventing them from accessing services, pretty poor services, it has to be said, and services that are being cut, but actually is preventing them from accessing services that other people have a right to access. And I think this is a sort of bit of a side, but I think this is also a problem, is that it's creating a special group of people who we have special, you know, special compassion for, and that we're putting lots of money for, but actually not very much money, but, you know, but still, you know, we're going to highlight this group, and then all the rest, they're bad people. You know, all the rest are bad people. And I think that, so it enshrines the idea that those people are pitiable, and really they can only be helped. That's, you know, and we're really so kind by helping those poor people. And it doesn't show that actually we have common interests, and that actually that's all the time what we need to be looking for. We have common interests, and actually, you know, it's not about helping. It's about recognising that we have a common struggle and that we have common interests. And I think, for me, perhaps the key point that the No Borders struggles really sort of pinpoints is that these common interests are not national. They're not about belonging to a nation. And in this way, I think it's a bit like kind of thinking about the terminology migrant. It's sort of a bit of a juggling act, because on the one hand, we always focus on formal citizenship. Well, I spend a lot of time talking about formal citizenship, about immigration rights, and about kind of making sure that people who are going to be deported kind of get some sort of status and go through some kind of legal position so that they can get their legal rights, and then and increasingly I'm really encouraging people to kind of get their indefinite leave to remain, go for British citizenship, because it's going to become really hard quite soon. So on the one hand, we talk about legal rights, but as I've said already, when thinking about the US, these legal rights, they're very fragile. You know, they're not, it's, you know, they're not great. And also, it's not just about legal rights. It's about the idea of the nation. It's this idea of belonging, not just about formal citizenship, but belonging to a certain kind of community. And this kind of community is one which is actually very exclusive. In fact, there's lots of British citizens who don't really belong to this kind of community. British citizens, black British citizens, don't really belong to this kind of community. Queer British citizens don't really belong. Criminals, no, not really. So there's this nation, there's this idea of a community of value as well as a formal community. and who's allowed to fit in kind of depends. So basically, if you're a black British citizen who's prepared, you know, who's kind of worried about immigration, then suddenly you'll be embraced as one of these, you know, yes, we're all worried about immigration, but actually your position is always going to be kind of like there on the edge, and you'd better realise when the chips are down where you stand. And so I think once we start thinking about the community of value and how we all feel about that, then we suddenly realise, hey, we've got, you know, a whole lot in common with other people, and trying to imagine a different kind of world. And I just want to say, in that document, Enforcing the Rules, it begins with John Reed saying this. So this is about the community of value. Britain is a country where people speak English, get on through merit, and play by the rules. Really. But it is really interesting. Whenever you read these immigration documents, they always start off with something about that. They have that, and then they have about how we've centuries we've given haven to refugees, blah, blah, blah. Like, always says that. Because it's almost like they've got to, you know, got to prove what a great nation it is and why everyone wants to come here. And so I think challenging nationalism is really important. And this isn't just challenging nationalism like BNP nationalism. That's easy. Everyone says, oh yeah, racism is real. Well, not everyone, but most people. You know, racism is bad. Even the government says, oh no, we don't have racist immigration controls. You know, they're all very bad. So they have to... So it's not... So challenging racism is important, but I think there's also a job in challenging nationalism with a small n, challenging the idea of, oh, it's okay to say, you know, yeah, well, we want the best for Britain. Well, what do you mean you want the best for Britain? What a sort of ridiculous thing to say. But actually, I can say that here, but that's actually not an easy thing to say generally in the sort of round of things. And I do think that it's really, that's something that we really start having to do, to say, well, what do you mean by Britain? What do you mean making migration work for Britain? That doesn't make any sense. I don't want the best thing for my country because I don't really believe that there's such a thing. I don't know what you mean by my country. And I suppose I also wanted just very briefly to talk about struggles and kind of the history of struggles that I feel that No Borders is a part of, and it's a long history of struggles that has won many battles, but you know, it's still, there's an awful long way to go. And I think you can start from the struggles of the diggers and the struggles against property, because in the end I feel that the property relation that really determines, because property relation isn't between me and this cup, I own this cup. The property relation is between me and Clara. She can't have that cup because it's mine. That's really what the property relation is. And I think that property relation is fundamentally inhuman. It doesn't bring out the best in us. We can't be confined to that property relation. It's not even about sharing, you know. It's not, I'm not going to share the cup with Clara. It's, the cup's there and we'll both use it. And that means that we have to really think fundamentally about relations between each other. And for me, I really draw hope from the idea of the commons, that actually the relation is that everybody has a right not to be excluded. And that's what I would take as a fundamental way forward. You have a right not to be excluded. There is plenty in this world. We can all live in this world and have, you know, a joyful, lovely, human and full life. Nobody has to be excluded. There's more than enough. You know, Vodafone, what was their tax rebate? 6 billion? Was that how much they got left off for their tax? You know, that's an awful lot of surplus wealth has been generated. And that's a global right, the right not to be excluded. And so I suppose I don't care that that's utopian, because I know that it's possible. And I also feel that No Borders really is, it's a, basically, for me, it's a politics of hope, not a politics of desperation, a politics of hope. And so that's why I thank you so much for inviting me.